Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. A planned detention facility for immigrants in Evanston, Wyoming, has led to an outcry here in Utah. The facility, proposed by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, would, as currently planned, have 1,000 beds and would serve as a holding facility for people waiting to appear in immigration court in West Valley City, more than 80 miles away. In 2017, ICE issued a request for proposals to build the new facility to support the immigration court in Utah's second largest city. At the time, several private prison companies expressed interest, including the Utah-headquartered Management and Training Corporation. But the proposal hasn't gone without opposition. The Catholic dioceses of Salt Lake City and Wyoming are opposed to the center's construction on the grounds that it's too far away from the immigration court in question, yes, but also, as you'll hear a little bit later in the show, because they are opposed to undue immigrant detention more broadly and to private prisons altogether.
Yes, we are opposed to all private prisons. The prison industry should not be a for-profit business.
That's Jean Hill from the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. We'll hear more from her just a little bit later in the show. Perhaps in part because of local opposition, the Utah-based Management and Training Corporation withdrew its interest in building the facility last August, saying it would prioritize growth elsewhere. That decision also came a year after 8 people were arrested at the company's Centerville headquarters, protesting MTC's involvement in ICE detention facilities and demanding the company pull out of the Evanston project. Before we turn to the specifics of local opposition to the Wyoming facility, we're going to first get an overview of how immigrant detention happens, why people are currently detained, and how their cases are adjudicated. And for that overview, we'll hear from Felipe de la Hoz, an independent immigration reporter whose work has been featured in The Village Voice, The Daily Beast, The Wall Street Journal, and on WNYC Radio, among other places. He's currently one of the authors of the weekly newsletter Borderlines, which provides context on immigration policy. Felipe de la Hoz, thank you very much for being here today.
My pleasure, Roger.
So on this show, we're talking about the fact that there's an immigrant detention facility planned for Evanston, Wyoming, to support an immigration court in West Valley City, Utah. And for people out there listening who perhaps never think about it, I'm hoping that you might be able to provide a window onto the world of immigrant detention, adjudication, and deportation as it currently operates. I'm imagining, and you can tell me if this framework is correct or not, but I'm imagining that there are sort of 4 parts to that process. A person is picked up by immigration officers. They are put into detention. There's some sort of court process that occurs, and then they are either deported or not. And if we start at step one of that process, an immigrant getting, picked up, who are the people targeted for arrest by immigration officials in the U.S. right now in January of 2020, Felipe?
Sure. So, the first step is kind of the issuance of what's called a notice to appear, which is basically a charging document, right, that lays out the allegations. And then, that person would probably be picked up by either ICE or CBP. So in terms of the sort of current framework of things right now, really, it's fair to say that almost anyone is being targeted. In fact, we're seeing in terms of the numbers that are recorded and put out by ICE, where, they make distinctions between, for example, people that have no criminal records and people that have, maybe different classes of records that it can be, from misdemeanor to violent felonies. The proportion of which people with what you could describe as serious criminal records is actually going down. And so more and more of the people that are being picked up tend to be people that, don't have any kind of a criminal record or have something very minor, like, some kind of traffic infraction. And part of the reason for this is that it's just easier to target these people. They can be arrested in a lot of courthouses. If an immigration officer knows that they're going to be there at that particular moment in time. And by and large, they're people that aren't really trying to hide in the same way that perhaps some, violent offenders may be. And so they're kind of low-hanging fruit. And once the current president, Mr. Trump, kind of went into office, he reversed some executive directives that had sort of limited the ways in which these people could be targeted. And so basically everyone is fair game now.
Anyone here without legal permission could be targeted for deportation. And again, as you said previously, there was this focus on hardened criminals or people who had committed, say, you know, a serious crime, and that was under the Obama administration. But what you're saying is that now at this moment, it could be anybody, whether or not they've been charged with a crime.
Yes. Okay. Under the Obama, actually, in 2014, he instituted something called the Priority Enforcement Program. Basically, what it said was that, you know, by executive action, the Department of Homeland Security essentially was to de-emphasize the arrests of certain people, for example, you know, who had been in the country for a long time and who had no sort of contact with the criminal justice system. And then that was rescinded. And so it's easier to kind of target those people now.
And then, well, you know, moving on to step two of what the sort of framework that I laid out, detention, is everybody who's picked up for an immigration violation of whatever kind then detained in prison somewhere? Or how does that work? How does that next step in the process go?
Right. So there are a number of people in immigration court in what are called removal proceedings that are not detained. You know, you can get an NTA in the mail, for example, that just lets you know that you are to present yourself at immigration court. But the people who are, you know, are arrested out and about, you know, in either in workplace raids or in kind of raids on their home or whatever else, you know, they are put in detention. Some of them are able to have a bond hearing where they can get bonded out of detention where while their removal proceeding is ongoing. But many of them basically end up spending the entire time that they are in removal proceedings before an immigration judge in detention. And the detention takes several forms. So some of it is just straight up federal detention, you know, the kind of federal jails that are used by, you know, marshals and other kind of federal entities. Right. But actually, the bulk of people are held in one of two other arrangements. One is, you know, ICE will have these agreements with local law enforcement officials that have jails. So, you know, you'll have a county jail somewhere, right, and they'll have a signed understanding where they can have sort of people detained there. Or, as you mentioned, it can be private detention. And there's a number of companies, the two largest are Geo Group and CoreCivic, that kind of provide these services for ICE and are very dependent on ICE as their client for this private detention.
For their business model.
Yes.
You know, so just moving on to that third step in the framework that I described, there's some kind of court process that takes place. And if we're talking about, you know, even this immigration court in West Valley City that we're discussing on the show today, are these courts within the U.S. criminal justice system? And what are the rules? Do I have a right to an attorney if I go to one of these courts? Can you describe that for us too, Felipe?
Sure thing. So there are actually a lot of misconceptions about this because people hear, you know, immigration court, and they kind of assume that it must be an Article I of the Constitution, you know, federal court, much as the, you know, district and circuit courts are. And actually, that's not the case. So the immigration courts are not part of the federal judiciary. They exist under the Department of Justice. So they're actually entirely executive branch of the government. So there's a department in the Department of Justice. There's an office called the Executive Office of Immigration Review, and it houses the structure of the immigration courts around the country. And so actually, the attorney general, whoever they may be at the time, can issue decisions, policy decisions, and also precedent decisions that affect all of the immigration courts. So the attorney general can actually overturn decisions that are made by the immigration courts and the appellate division of the immigration courts, which is called the Board of Immigration Appeals. Most people don't know that. As far as the right to counsel, also a common misconception, in the criminal context, as we know, you have an absolute right to, you know, be represented by an attorney, you know, before the government. In the immigration context, because it's a civil proceeding and not a criminal one, that precedent was never established by the Supreme Court. And so if you cannot afford an attorney and you cannot otherwise find someone who will represent you pro bono, you actually don't get one. The government will not provide an attorney.
Okay. Finally, what an immigration judge decides about an individual's case is going to decide that person's fate in terms of whether or not they are removed from the country. Do we know percentages there, how broad a spectrum there is when it comes to what that judge's decision might look like? How, you know, like how many people are actually, you know, who go through the system right now are having their case decided so that they have to be removed from the country?
Across the board, we're seeing the percentages of people that are granted relief, whether that means, you know, they're granted asylum or their, you know, their case is tossed or they're otherwise, you know, allowed to stay in the country. Those percentages are going down as some of the administration's changes to the immigration court system take effect. But so when you're in removal proceedings, it basically means just that the government is trying to remove you for whatever reason based on some evidence, right? And the judges, you know, are there to make a determination basically on whether, you know, you should be removed from the country. And so, you know, we're seeing the numbers go down. And I want to emphasize that it actually varies a lot depending on what court you're in. So, for example, New York City has the highest grant rate of, you know, of granting relief for people that are appear before it. The Atlanta court, on the other hand, has a very, very high denial rate. In fact, there's one immigration judge in Atlanta that has a 100% denial rate so far, meaning that she has not granted relief in a single case. And, you know, there's not really much to be done about this. You know, you're in the jurisdiction that you're in, but it is very dependent where you are arrested and where you are, you know, appearing before a judge, the chances that you have of being successful in a, you know, in a bid to stay in the country.
Okay. Felipe, I'm looking at the time that we've eaten up here, and I'm wondering, you know, is there a big piece of the detention and adjudication aspect of the immigration system that we're sort of leaving to the side right now?
No, I think if there's one thing that I would want to leave people with, it's that, you know, for any way you slice it, it ends up being a very capricious system where, you know, the reasons that things are happening are sometimes very opaque. For example, there's new quotas on how many cases, you know, judges have to try in a particular year. And it really, you know, if we think of courts as something where due process happens, I think a lot of objective observers would say that, you know, that's being eroded right now, and that really, you know, whatever it is that's happening in these courts is not something that we would be able to call real, true due process, where each side gets a fair shake at presenting their evidence. And this is both because of the backlog of how many more cases there are than there used to be, and it's also just because of different priorities under this particular administration. But, you know, I would urge people to kind of keep a lookout on that, because it's something that is generally happening sort of out of view and in this opaque system. And it's something that I think people that are consider themselves civil libertarians or believers in due process should be really examining closely.
Okay. Felipe de Laz, independent immigration reporter and one of the authors of the weekly immigration newsletter, Borderlines. Thank you very much for taking time to explain this all to us today.
Thank you for having me. I hope it was clarifying.
So with that background out of the way on how the system operates, we'll now turn to the local picture, and in particular, local opposition to the proposal to build a private prison in Evanston, Wyoming, to service the immigration court in West Valley City. Recently, I sat down with Gene Hill, director of the Office of Life, Justice, and Peace with the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City, and we began our conversation by talking about that planned detention facility. The reason for this conversation is the opposition that the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City and also Wyoming's Catholic Diocese is raising to a proposed immigrant detention center, one that is proposed for Evanston, Wyoming. And the first and most basic and obvious question is, what's at the root of the opposition to this facility? Why do you oppose it?
You know, and there's two roots to that. One is the way that detention is going right now. And then the second is that this is a for-profit company using people as their commodity. And we are always opposed to the private prison concept or the private detention center concept, but also the fact that we are detaining non-criminal individuals in facilities with razor wire top fences and treating them as criminals as a matter of immigration policy. And that's really, to us, a very poor policy decision on the part of the country on how we're going to deal with our immigration situation, and one that, you know, politics created by not dealing with immigration reform over the past 3 decades. And also, I mean, and bottom line is detention is more expensive and less effective for ensuring, because really the rationale for doing this detention that we're doing is to make sure people show up for their removal hearings. But the data shows most people, 95%, will show up for their removal hearings if you have case management and or if they have connections in the community, most of whom will have connections in the community. You don't come from Mexico border to Utah unless you've got somebody here that you're hoping to join with, you know, a family member you're going to live with. So we don't even need detention. And what we've seen over the years is, as the private prison companies have lobbied for more detention facilities, We've seen the numbers in detention go up intentionally. So Congress sets the floor on how many are detained. And I believe right now the floor is at 32,000. But we have 52,000 people in detention. And again, if it was a matter of public safety, that's one aspect. And if you are going to assess the risk of people, great. And you want to put people who are clearly a risk to the public in a detention facility, fine. But that's not what we're doing. That is not what those 52,000 people represent. So it is a matter of, we're just saying, okay, if you came over and you don't have papers, you're going into a secure facility. And that's just poor policy.
And that policy, I mean, the driver for that policy is the profit margin of private prison companies?
Well, I think they've helped make it possible, because I think that they have seen, you know, as the market for private prisons, whatever has happened to that market, they've seen this detention market as a way to really build another aspect of their business. Because again, you get paid for having those beds available. I mean, I think Dilley, Texas, and I may be wrong on the location, but one of those private detention centers, they get paid whether the beds are filled or not. That's actually not usually the case. Usually they get paid as long as the beds are filled. So there's always a interest in having policies that will keep those beds filled. And then once you get people in the beds, keeping people in those beds. You know, that raises another concern, which is, as a humane policy, this isn't. This is really saying people are just to fill beds. And that's, you know, we are highly opposed to this idea that people are just a commodity for these companies.
Is the position of the Catholic Diocese that all private prisons, wherever they may be, are wrong because of that commodification of people you just
right.
described?
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay. We are opposed to all private prisons. The prison industry should not be a for-profit business. You know, we are mass incarcerating in this country. We have more incarcerated people than any other developed nation in the world. We have created a situation where, regardless of what might be best for the individual who has done something wrong, no question, We're not worried about what's best for ensuring that when they come out of those facilities, they're going to be productive members of society. We are, at this point, it seems, worried about, can we keep these for-profit companies in business? And that's just a horrible policy. You know, I don't know whether the way to say it. We believe in the dignity and sanctity of every life, and a dignified life isn't one where you are there just to make a company money.
So you said it would be cheaper to basically allow people to be out and then have case management and show up for their court dates. Politics probably plays a hand as well?
Yeah, I think absolutely it plays a hand. Because I think if you look at the numbers, and I can tell you, for an individual, detention costs about $124 per day. Some of the different alternatives to detention can be as low as $10 a day. So there really isn't an economic rationale for this. I do believe right now immigration policy across the board is designed to deter people from coming. And I think what we're missing as a country is that the reason that they keep coming isn't because of our policies here, it's because of what's happening in their home countries. So as bad as you make it here, what's happening at home is far worse. So if we really wanted to do something about immigration, we would be helping those home countries address their problems, their abject poverty, their violence, those issues. That would be far more effective than throwing people into razor wire fenced facilities and denying them adequate food and medical care, because that's really not doing the trick. And it's not going to do the trick, because the bottom line is people have hope here that if they get through this process, they are going to be able to have a dignified life. And they know they can't get that at home right now.
There's also the fact that this isn't really playing out as a criminal issue, meaning there's a question of fundamental rights, you know, that being an immigrant isn't actually a
right.
criminal.
And it's not a crime. Their trial process isn't in the criminal courts. It's a civil process. These are non-criminals who we are treating as criminals. You know, that crime of coming across the border, if you want to call it a crime, which it's not, you know, coming across the border is not a criminal act. It's a civil violation. It's like you speeding down the street. You're not going to jail for that. It's not a great idea, and it's dangerous. You know, I'm far more dangerous than coming across the border without papers, but you're not going to jail for it unless you're drunk, right? So it's non-criminal, and all of the immigration processes, all of the trials that we're trying to get these folks to show up for are not happening in criminal courts. They're happening in civil courts, but we're treating the individuals as though they are hardened criminals, which the vast majority are not. And I think you'll see, too, if you look at the numbers, 73% of these detention facilities are privately run for-profit facilities. We're only treating these folks like criminals, in my mind, because A, we have a misguided sense that it's going to deter them, or B, we're just keeping a business running that has some powerful lobbyists.
Okay, so and there's the first part of that is part of the political calculus that any given administration at the federal level might choose to do to try and deter. What about the distance from where this facility is proposed to be and where the actual hearings take place? Can you talk about the distance and what that means for people who are being detained?
Absolutely. The distance, I think, is intentional. I think it is designed to separate people from their support communities. And we know in the criminal process, we know in prison and jails, when you do that, you actually have far worse outcomes. Not to mention that these are folks for whom finding attorneys that they can afford is going to be a huge challenge as is. Finding an attorney 90 miles away from where their court hearing is going to happen is ridiculously difficult for them. They're not going to be able to have family come and visit. You're not going to be able to get, you know, a local Evanston attorney necessarily who can even present in a court in Utah. If there are immigration attorneys available in Evanston for this, however many people they're planning in this facility. So you are denying access to legal counsel in some way, and you're definitely denying access to those family supports who, if you let the person stay with the family support, 95% of them will show up for those removal proceedings.
So part of the impetus for this happening is that ICE is requesting the construction of a facility somewhere nearby, kind of nearby. And that's because the Utah County Correctional Facility, the Utah County Jail, I guess, said, we don't want to do this anymore. We don't want to hold prisoners for ICE anymore. You know, one part of what you described was that trafficking in the souls of human beings, you know, having them detained as a matter of money making. If it was a state facility, would that be somewhat better in your mind?
Sort of. You would need two changes. You would need a process that really is making sure that you're only detaining those for whom there is a real flight risk or there is a real public safety risk. If you were making those determinations and you were putting them in a state facility, that would be better. And I think, you know, again, if you look at the history of private prisons, the prisons that they've run have typically been less safe, understaffed. The pay has been horrible. They have had more violence problems within their prisons because of the way that they do things. So I think that in terms of as a business model, state-run facilities, county-run facilities just do a better job than the private companies do. And I think that is reflected in the fact that the state doesn't have a profit motive. It has a public safety motive.
Gene Hill, Director of the Office of Life, Justice, and Peace with the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. Thanks again for making time.
Thank you for having me.
During our interview, Gene Hill pointed out that Utah has historically been opposed to private prisons. I wanted to learn more about that history and why there aren't any private prisons in Utah, at least not yet. And to get that background, I turned to Steve Erickson. He's an activist, a member of the nonprofit watchdog Citizen Education Project, and a longtime local opponent of private prisons. Steve Erickson, thanks very much for being here on In the Hive.
My pleasure.
As someone who has been following this, why is it that there are no private prisons in the state of Utah?
Well, the citizenry was able to rise up and say no to a proposed private prison plan that was originally to be financed by the legislature. In the 1997 general session, the final hours, final days, there was a $2 million appropriation to begin the process of creating Utah's first private prison for men. And we became aware of it after the fact. Decided it was something that was wrong and needed to be stopped, and did some organizing work. Eventually, what came out of this process was four bids in four separate cities around the state of Utah. And citizens organized in three of those four to mount some significant opposition at the very local grassroots level in Delta, in Roosevelt, and in Fillmore. And Price, a fourth community in Grantsville, decided that they would accept the private prison project. But and that was where the opposition originated from, our little effort, that Citizens Education Project, and escalated into almost a statewide opposition We contacted the Sheriff's Association and the Chiefs of Police Association, and they're the unions that are involved with law enforcement and incarceration in the state of Utah, Public Employees Union, the AFSCME. And we had pretty much 100% opposition there to the private prison concept and plan.
And they expressed that to lawmakers, and lawmakers didn't fund this appropriation.
Well, they did fund it originally, and then when that was enough to kickstart the process. So it began in 97 and then didn't conclude until the 2000 general session. So it was a three-year battle that really was begun from my perspective anyway, right here in Salt Lake City with the three guys at a local establishment deciding we were going to take it on.
Is there a state ordinance now, or language in state code preventing our having private prisons in Utah?
No, but there is a provision that we managed to get into the statutes. I believe it was probably in 99, could have been 98. That statute prohibited the importation of out-of-state inmates for incarceration in a private prison in Utah.
Which puts a cramp on the business model of private prisons.
It flummoxed the lobbyists for the private prison industry. They didn't see it coming, didn't think it had any momentum, and it really messed with the business plan of a private prison. They would not have been able to make enough money to make it worthwhile, in our estimation, to come here if they were just going to incarcerate Utah inmates.
The U.S. has the largest number of people in prison of any country in the world by a pretty sizable amount. I mean, more than China or India, countries with larger populations, according to data that's been collected by the Sentencing Project. Maybe because of that, these private prisons say that they are filling a niche in the market, that they do their work well. And what's your answer to their just saying, look, we are a necessary business model, given the reality of the fact that the U.S. does incarcerate so many people?
Well, they have certainly carved out a role within the system economically. I don't think that justifies the business plan, but their track record has been really abysmal throughout the years that we've watched, and that's 20-plus years now of keeping an eye on private prisons. And
track record in terms of
poor services, low pay, high turnover for staffing, poor medical care, lack of medical response in emergencies within the system, escapes, bad food, riots internally, violence inside of these institutions, and that's going to occur everywhere. I mean, it occurs in county jails, it occurs in state prisons, it occurs in federal prisons. It's going to be part of what goes on when you incarcerate human beings. But the private prison track record is far worse than the government-operated system. And we saw lots of ideological discussion and pushback against that notion among legislators. Oh, well, the private sector always does it better, and we need to privatize every government service we possibly can. Well, that's been a false narrative. It's kind of like believing in a free market as if it provides a free lunch or something. There isn't one. And so we have to disabuse that notion. And I think we've managed in Utah to stem three other efforts to revive private prisons, and they never really got much traction. So I don't think we're going to see that happen anytime soon. But, having a private prison for immigrants on our border, when we're going to be the main source of those people being adjudicated here in the state of Utah in West Valley City, that's too close to home. So I'm really pleased that these young activists and the Catholic Church and immigrant advocates and immigrant attorneys have all denounced this plan and working hard to stop it.
I was going to say that there are some people out there who will hear this in the context of those immigration proceedings, and they'll think, well, we need a place to detain people because we have people coming here without authorization. And again, in the minds of some people who are hearing this, they need to be removed from the country. And does your opposition to private prisons have anything to do with immigration, or is it more about the model of how people are held? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's a big issue in all of itself, and how we treat immigrants and how we allow for refugees and how we deal with political prisoners and people fleeing because they're political enemies of the state where they came from
or
are called that, or at least they're given that label. So those are really complex questions. But if we're going to be detaining people, we can't do it on the cheap. I mean, my goodness, you can't be putting children in cages. That's just counter to all that we should stand for as a people, as a nation. So if we're going to do this, we got to do it right. And to simply say, well, we're going to farm it out to the lowest bidder contracting, I think is a big mistake that's going to come back to haunt us.
Steve Erickson with the Citizens Education Project, thanks.
Important story.
Again, that's Steve Erickson with the nonprofit watchdog Citizen Education Project, providing some background on the history of opposition to private prisons here in Utah. For the record, we reached out to a spokesperson with Management and Training Corporation, the private prison company based here in Utah, to try to get the perspective of a company involved in the business of incarceration. They declined that request based on what they said were several business factors, including new initiatives taking up too much of their time. And again, for the record, MTC is not moving forward with a bid for the Evanston Detention Facility. We also reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement to discuss the Wyoming project, and were told by a public affairs officer that to maintain the integrity of the contracting process, ICE doesn't discuss contracts that may be in negotiation, and that with the bid process for the facility closing at the end of February, they may be able to address questions at that time. We then asked for an interview more generally talking about ICE's use of private prisons, but agency officials were not available to discuss this in advance of our air date. However, in an email, Public Affairs Officer Alethea Smock said that there's a huge misconception that ICE indiscriminately detains people. She said that the reality is that roughly 90% of the people ICE arrests have either been convicted of a crime, charged with a crime, or are an immigration fugitive, meaning they've been through the immigration process we described at the start of the show and have been ordered removed by a judge. Finally, just a note that each of the interviews we aired today ran much longer than we could fit into the broadcast clock. We'll therefore have a much longer podcast version of this show, including the entirety of the interviews with today's guests. You can find that at kcpw.org or through whatever app you use to listen. That does it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, independent public radio resource. If you've got feedback on our programs or questions you want answered about your community, email comments@kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week.